topic tonight will be the Roaring Twenties. The Roaring Twenties. Okay, we're going to discuss the 20s of a while back, 100 years ago. So we're going to discuss 1921 through roughly 1927. Last time, we ended with the Jaffa riots of 1921, the May Day riots, where the Jews got into fisticuffs with each other between the Bolsheviks and the Poalitzion socialists, and then they ended up hitting an Arab, and the Arabs went wild, and a lot of people got killed, 47 Jews, 48 Arabs. This was very bloody, much worse than the Nebi Musa riots of the year before in Jerusalem. And Yosef Chaim Brenner, the famous writer, was one of those killed. The response of the British authorities to the Jaffa riots was to temporarily halt Jewish immigration. That's a nice, convenient way to placate the Arabs. It's a standard practice. If the Jews want immigration, the Arabs are annoyed by it, the Arabs are causing trouble, well then, temporary halt. Golda Meir, or Goldie Meyerson as she was known at that time, was on a boat that was in the Mediterranean trying to get into Israel, and she was delayed by a few weeks because of this temporary halt in immigration. At the time, the Zionist leadership was out of the country. Weizmann, Sishkin, Jabotinsky, Ben-Gurion were all, for each of them independent reasons, happened to be out of the country, and so the second-tier leadership had to take the helm. Guys like David Eder, Yitzchak Ben-Zvi, Arthur Ruppin, and Nachum Sokolow. And they're seething at Herbert Samuel, looking at a Jewish high commissioner and saying how he's caving into Arab pressure. So there's ill will between the Zionist leadership and a man who's running the country, who's ostensibly a Zionist and is an open Jew. Okay. The Haycraft Commission was the commission that was established after these riots. Every riot had a follow-up commission, and every commission produced a 500-page report that always said the same thing, that effectively the Arabs are to blame for the riots, but we understand their motivation in rioting because the British authorities have yet to come to a way of reconciling Jewish aspirations, aggressive Jewish aspirations, with Arab sentiment. So the Arabs are at fault, but they're not really at fault, because we can't blame them for being angry. The conclusion of the Haycraft Commission's report was that Arabs are more obedient, but more violent. Jews are less obedient and less violent. Now, it's not a stira, it's not a contradiction. On the whole, Arabs are easier to deal with because they follow whatever the colonial authorities tell them to do, except when they're going crazy, when they're killing. Jews don't pay attention to rules. Their Zionism trumps their willingness to adhere to British rule, but they don't kill people, on the whole. Okay. So that was the conclusion of the Haycraft Commission. one of the important results of the 21 riots, and this is symbolic, but it's more than just symbolic. It's of critical importance for our understanding. Tel Aviv and Jaffa were separated into two municipalities. Why does that matter? Well, at the time, it was just a bureaucratic detail, because in reality, Tel Aviv was a small city that was still reliant upon the population in Jaffa to do the work in Tel Aviv, to supply it with food every day. There were not really separate economies yet. They would be eventually. But the idea is, by separating the municipalities, it was symbolic of and indicative of the separation of Arab and Jew more generally, so that the Yishuv in British Mandate Palestine becomes a state within a state, not just in terms of the bureaucracy, you know, the civil service state within a state, but that the entire existence of the Jew need not depend upon the presence of Arabs in the country. That the producers, the consumers, the manufacturers of any given product, the service, it's all a cycle of Jewish economy, self-sustained, and a Jewish city, no longer reliant upon, in the near future, on the Arab indigenous population, like in Jaffa. Okay. So there was one more riot before peace broke out, and that last riot was on November 2nd, 1921. November 2nd is important for being the anniversary of what? Balfour Declaration. So on the fourth anniversary of the Balfour Declaration, there was another riot in Jerusalem in which there were five Jews dead in the Old City. The Jews blamed Ronald Storrs, who was the governor of Jerusalem, and he responded, "Never was a goy more mercilessly pogromed than I was." So he didn't like the fact that the Jews tended to blame all outbursts of violence on him when they happened in the Jerusalem sector. Okay, so in June of 1921, Herbert Samuel issued a rule that immigration henceforth would be governed by the economic absorptive capacity of the country. That if the country could not sustain high levels of immigration, well, then we'll reduce the quota to fit whatever the economy can handle. The Jews did not like this, and they called him a traitor. David Eder wanted Herbert Samuel replaced. Arthur Uppen and Chaim Weizmann said, no, let's keep Herbert Samuel in the job, because after all, he is a Jew, and he is nominally a Zionist, and he's our guy. It's just he has to learn to behave like one of us. Ke'echad mimenu, like one of us. That's an unfair statement for Weizmann to make, because really, what is Herbert Samuel's job? He's a British official. He's not there because he's a Zionist. He's there to do the bidding of the British Empire. And he's not one of them. He may be a Jew and a Zionist, but he's a British official. Okay. So, what was Herbert Samuel trying to accomplish in the early years of his administration? Remember, he gets there in 1920, he leaves 1925. What he tried to do was to create a country called Palestine, in which there is a mixture of Jew and Arab, and everyone is proud of their Palestinian national identity, a common Palestinian national identity. This failed. It failed miserably. The Jews were devoted to the cause of Jewish nationalism, and the Arabs were devoted to the cause of Arab nationalism, those who cared. Most others were just indifferent and wanted to live their lives. So what can you do to make Palestine into a country? If you're a British official, colonial official, who was in charge of a mandate, and you want to create a country, what do you do? So that's the one thing they won't do. The one thing they won't do is have representative government, but rather the British will control as a colonial power. But if you put that one critical detail aside, what can you do to create a country? So the one answer is a currency. Instead of using the Egyptian lira, they create the Palestine pound. That the Palestine pound was a British colonial currency, but was specific to Palestine. Its own postage stamps. Okay, a functioning civil service, which is not beholden to a democratically elected government, but is beholden to a colonial regime, but still
overseen by the British.
Obviously, yes. So they have their own currency, their own postage, a functioning civil service, to an extent involved in education and social welfare, but basically, and citizenship, most important. Citizenship, that everyone who lives in the country legally, that's important, legally, if you're illegal you can't, but if you're legally there, you can take Palestinian citizenship, and you have to renounce whatever other citizenship you had. So many Jews did this. Where did they come from? They came from Poland, Russia, Romania, wherever they came from. They renounced the citizenship of their lands of their birth and became Palestinian citizens with a new passport.
Why the name Palestine?
That's what the British called it. It's been around since the days of the Romans. Okay.
There seem to be contradictions of the Lord. What is the Enron? Was it a colony?
Okay. So,
an independent state.
Okay, that's a very important question. From the Arab point of view, the sooner representative democracy could be achieved, the better, because they hold the then current demographic majority by a wide margin. From a Jewish perspective, the goal is to increase the population in raw numbers and in relative numbers so that the percentage of the population that is Jewish will go from 10% to 15% to 20% to blah, 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 all up to 50. And once it's past 50, that's the threshold at which Jewish statehood is possible, which is into the distant future, but the dream is to get to that level. By the way, they didn't get to that level, which is why partition was necessary, and even with partition, there was a need for shenanigans during the War of 48. Okay, but from a British point of view, it's entirely unclear what their end game is. They've made promises to the Jews that we're going to build up the national home, but they never explicitly made a promise about statehood, which means that the British regime in Palestine is there for the sake of being there, and its timetable for departure is non-existent. It will only emerge when the violence gets so bad that they don't want to stay anymore. Okay, but in the early 1920s, that's an unknown future. Okay, so in the early 20s, Weizmann, who's in charge of the Zionist organization, has domestic enemies. His domestic enemies are David Ben-Gurion and Vladimir Jabotinsky, whom he regards as young and reckless hotheads. By the way, what's the age difference between the three men? Not that much. Weizmann was born in 1874, Jabotinsky was born in 1880, and Ben-Gurion was born in 1886. Ah, but there's enough of a difference that you could say they're these young whippersnappers. Who do they think they are?
Weizmann at this time is in England or in Palestine?
So Weizmann nominally lives in Palestine, in Rehovot, but in reality is gallivanting around the world for the next decade and a half, so long as he's the official head of the movement. Actually, not decade and a half, really for the next 2.5 decades, through World War II, because he's head of the movement from 1920 through 1946, leaving out 31 to 35 when Sokolow was in charge. Okay, so the Zionist Commission gives way and becomes the Zionist Executive, which is like the cabinet that will be in charge of what will eventually morph into the Jewish Agency. And Weizmann is in control. Jabotinsky is involved, but Jabotinsky will resign in bitter protest in 1923, having only served for 2 years. Why does he resign? Because he believes that Weizmann is head over heels in love with the British. He's an Anglophile to a fault, and that the Zionist movement is insufficiently antagonistic to the British regime when they deserve it. That when they deserve it, we got to punch back hard a little. You know, they have to know that we're dissatisfied with the way they're treating us.
Didn't Weizmann have to owe the British a little bit because of the Balfour Declaration?
Yes. So Weizmann
that made him.
Is a diplomat. Jabotinsky is not really much of a diplomat. Right. He's a public servant in a variety of ways, but not really the good diplomat. He's a politician.
He's a bit of a bomb thrower.
A bomb thrower, correct. And the big issue for him in 1923 was that the Churchill White Paper of 1922 had severed Transjordan from Palestine, and he believed in Shtei Gedot HaYarden, the two sides of the two banks of the Jordan, which would be the slogan of Beitar for the next 25 years. Okay. Now let's get to a cultural highlight. In 1923, Albert Einstein showed up in Jerusalem, and he gave a lecture. This Hebrew University does not yet exist. It had been the foundation stone had been laid in 1918. Classes would not begin until 1925, but he's there supporting the cause of Hebrew University, and he gives a lecture on relativity. All the prominent players in the yeshuv come to this lecture. It's so crowded that if you got there late, there was no standing room only. Achad Ha'am had to stand. He was an old man, but he had to stand. He couldn't get a seat. Nobody would give him a seat. And nobody understood the lecture, but everyone pretended to understand the lecture. He gave it in French, because that was because he didn't speak Hebrew, and his English wasn't that good yet, so he gave it in French. Okay. When he traveled around the country, so it's interesting what he said. Einstein saw Jews praying at the Western Wall and was very saddened by the idea of devout Jews muttering prayers in front of stones. He didn't like that. He thought it was from the old world and not boding well for the future. But then he went to Degania, Kibbutz Degania, and he was very impressed. He liked what he saw, but he had an interesting comment and a great foresight. He said, they're doing great things, but their communism won't last forever. It'll eventually fizzle out. In other words, the agricultural yeshuv is a wonderful experience, but it's avowed leftism will only last for so long before it dissipates. He was right. Okay. Some people in the yeshuv opposed the building up of a Hebrew university, thinking that it was too expensive, it was a waste of money when there are many more urgent material needs of Jews in the land of Israel. Are they right? Yeah. Of course they're right. There are urgent material needs, and Zionism is not a wealthy movement, despite the fact that there are wealthy Jews. The Tatanua Tzionit, the Zionist movement, was always short of funds, and to sink thousands and thousands and thousands of pounds into brick and mortar and professorial staff of a university when you're trying to build up a settlement all over the country, it's a fair criticism. Okay? Alternatively, some people were afraid that the existence of Hebrew University in Jerusalem would cause the expulsion of Jewish students who were enrolled in other universities around the world. Now, that's the academic version of the criticism of Zionism more generally. If there's a state of Israel, what's going to happen to the Jews in Romania? The Romanian dictator will say, get out of here, go to Palestine, go to Israel, where there's a Jewish state. So you could say that, you could always use that argument, that if there's a Jewish something, they'll kick you out of the Goyish or something.
That's the game plan.
Well, whose game plan?
People who believe in
them. No, so it's the game plan of the anti-Semites and the Zionists.
Right, both.
All right, good. Now, some were okay with a science faculty, natural sciences, on the grounds that they'll produce people who will be able to help the yeshuv, engineers, agronomists, you know, people with real technical expertise that could help a flourishing agricultural society. But they said no to liberal arts or abstract scholarship, you know, scholarship for the sake of scholarship. And then the criticism was, what will we do with hundreds of doctors and lawyers? We don't need them. And some criticize they're valuing a diploma over the scent of the earth, that the smell of the soil of Eretz Yisrael, that's what matters, not a sheepskin. Okay? Then, the Zionist leadership, however, decided that Hebrew University was a priority, and especially after the riots of 1920 and 21, there was a need for some success. You know, they say in Pirkei Avos, mitzvah gereres mitzvah, and avera gereres avera, and in baseball you have a hot streak and a cold streak, okay? You can go 5 for 5 or you get the golden sombrero. Well, you need to have a victory to keep the movement going. We need to build this university to show that Zionism is a winning movement, and not a loser's movement, getting pushed around by the riots. Well, there was also a concern. If you don't make a Hebrew university, you know what's going to happen? There's going to be a British university. Or an Arab university, even worse. Now, there never was a British university in Palestine. It never happened. Arab universities would come to be post-1967. Israel would establish them in the territories. Okay. Now, Menachem Osishkin said, we don't have the money for a full-scale university just yet. What are we going to have to make do with at first? A Jewish studies department. Mada'i Yahadut. And he also noted that the useful sciences are not national, which is the exact opposite argument to what I just told you. I just said the natural sciences will produce agronomists and engineers who could help the yeshuv. True, but you could go to school in Paris or Berlin for that. You don't need to go to school in Jerusalem for that. Rather, we need a national university, and what is national? Judaic studies. Judaic studies. So remember, this is not a yeshiva with a Rosh Yeshiva and a Rebbe, but rather it's going to be Judaic studies with Gershom Scholem and Fritz Bauer and all the gedolim of academic scholarship. Okay, Joseph Klausner and others. We're going to see Klausner in a second. Then, David Yellen, who was the leader of the Jewish community in terms of the domestic leadership, not the Jewish agency, but the Vaad Le'umi, he complained about Julius Rosenwald. Okay, now we saw a movie about Julius Rosenwald, a big tzaddik. He gave $2 million to build schools for blacks in the American South. So that's a wonderful thing. from the standpoint of American philanthropy, but David Yellen, the Zionist, used a choice, inappropriate word to say he gave $2 million to them, but he won't fund a chair at Hebrew University. So it goes to show you could be a tzaddik in one part of the world and be mocked in another part of the world for what you didn't do there. All right.
Julius Rosenberg, wasn't he involved with the American Council for Judaism later on?
No, Lessing Rosenwald, his son was.
Oh, that was his son.
His son, yeah.
I mean, evil.
Elmer Berger, yeah. He was the PLO rabbi.
Ooh.
Okay. So, the Jewish community at that time was forming itself institutionally, and in 1920 there was an election. There was an election for the Aseifat Nivcharim, the Assembly of Representatives, which would then elect a Vad Lumi, a National Council, which would be in charge of education and social welfare, religion, those sorts of things. Like the domestic portfolios in any modern government. Well, this election was not recognized by the British as being legally binding. It was an internal yeshuv affair. It would not be recognized by the British as having any legal standing until the late 1920s. And in the course of the whole history of the British Mandate, there were only four such elections, 1920, 1926, 1931, and 1944. The goal was to enroll as many Jews as possible in this Knesset Yisrael, this Congregation of Israel, to prove to the British authorities and to the world community that the Jews of Palestine are a cohesive bunch and are ready eventually for statehood. Now, it's a few decades away, but you got to build the institutions. The problem is that there are dissident factions who might not want to participate in a so-called Knesset Yisrael. Who?
Communists.
Yeah, who else?
Extreme religious.
Good. So those are the two groups. The communists and the extreme religious. So Rav Kook, who is the chief rabbi first of Jaffa, then of Jerusalem, and a year later will be hired by the Knesset Yisrael as the chief rabbi of Palestine, so he's an employee of the Knesset Yisrael, he is involved in this and issues a halakhic ruling that women can't vote. Why? It's not sneus.
Rav
Kook said that, yeah. Okay.
What year?
1920. So bear in mind, in America, the 19th Amendment is just passed, but in plenty of Western countries, women did not have suffrage. But the Zionist movement had long been very egalitarian. Ever since the beginning, from 1897, there were women delegates to the first Zionist Congress. So this is not going to fly with mainstream Zionism to eliminate the franchise for the ladies. But, on the other hand, we want to make sure the Haredim are participating in this institution, this Aseifat Nivcharim, Knesset Yisrael. So what's going to give? Women's suffrage or Haredi participation? All right, so Joseph Klausner, who goes on to become a professor at Hebrew University and is a real nationalist, he was a candidate for the presidency of Israel, the first go-around against Chaim Weizmann, and he lost to Weizmann. Klausner is most famous for writing Jesus of Nazareth, which was a book in which he says that Jews may not believe that Jesus is the Son of God, but they should know that Jesus was an avowed nationalist Jew, a rebel fighter for the cause. And that didn't go over well with most people, and it probably also is totally inaccurate. But he wrote it. Okay, so...
I read the book. I had it for a course in law.
Yeah, I had the book too, yeah.
He has several books, and I have them all, but I didn't catch that from the book.
Well, I haven't read the book in a long time. It's been about 15 years. I couldn't tell you what's in the book. But Klausner in his time was... espousing this theory about Jesus that didn't win him too many friends. It was like a radical and arguably inaccurate view. But in any event, why do I bring up Klausner? He said, we need to have this election. We need maximum participation. Therefore, ladies, concede this time and don't vote. So a compromise was, the women will vote, but the Haredi women won't vote, and their husbands will get two votes. on the premise that the women are going to vote like the men, so you give them two votes and everybody's happy. You go, okay. So that didn't work out. That was not done. Ultimately, everybody had the franchise.
This was Klausner
saying? No. This was a different suggestion. The Mizrahi came up with this one. Rabbi Maimon came up with that one. Rabbi Fishman. So the election goes off and everybody can vote. Very nice. Who wins this election? Well, everybody's a winner in the game of life. But the point is that the labor camp does very well for itself. The other camp is what? There's the left and there's the right. But there really isn't the right. No. There's the left and there's everyone else. And the everyone else are not ideologically motivated. They don't even have a good name for themselves. They're known as the civil camp, the labor camp, and the civil camp. It's only in post-1948 Israel that the division becomes, and it's not even right away, it's only really after the Six-Day War, or maybe a little before, you have the left and the right as sort of the nationalist camp. It gives itself a better name. But in the beginning, it was the civil camp. These are the non-socialists. These are the urban dwellers, the middle class, the bourgeois, the people that the left makes fun of on the grounds that they don't work hard enough, they don't get their fingernails dirty.
So who are the general Zionists?
That's them, the civil camp, the general Zionists. But the general Zionists as an organization don't even exist yet. Remember, general Zionism is the successor to Theodor Herzl, to Max Nordau, arguably to Chaim Weizmann, but they don't have an ideology other than general Zionism. But the general is with like a lowercase g, not an uppercase g. So they have to develop an ideology that is negating someone else's ideology. Meaning they're capitalists, they're laissez-faire capitalists, but it's not what animates them, they're just not socialist. And they're not far right or far left on matters of war and peace, they're just sort of in the middle. There's the bland moderates who are not one thing or the other. And that doesn't win over a lot of votes. So even though in the 1920s, out of 100,000 immigrants, Jewish immigrants to Israel, only 20,000 worked the soil on kibbutzim and agricultural settlements, 20%, despite that fact, what happened by 1930, 31, 32, 33? The labor side of the aisle took over the whole politics of the country. And would retain control over the country till when? 1977. So for 45 years, they're in control. Not because numerically they have an absolute majority. In fact, they never had a majority. But they were the strongest ideological faction. And that goes a long way. That goes a very long way. Okay.
Begin broke
that. So Begin broke that by doing very smart things. And last year we discussed this at length. What did he do? He was able to take the revisionists, who were a small faction, expand them into a nationalist right, and then combine the nationalist right with the liberal center. By liberal, I mean economically liberal, of capitalism. And by combining the center with the right, they were eventually able, after some cycles of losing, to outpace the left side of the aisle. Of course, the Yom Kippur War had a lot to do with it, but the political alignments also had a lot to do with it.
But it still created a lot of anxiety, I remember, in America.
Oh, sure, yeah. A terrorist is the prime minister, yeah. Okay, so, now, the in 1924... there was a political assassination. And we have to discuss why this happened, who did it, and what's the background. So, huh? No, Dizengoff died in his bed, an old man. He wasn't assassinated.
Hey, Alan's something on the beach.
Okay, so our Lasarov is 1933. We're not up to that yet. We'll be up to that in 3 or 4 weeks. 1924 is the assassination of Jacob Israel Dahan. Dahan was a Dutch Jew who came from a religious family, and he then went the secular route and was a journalist or a lawyer, did a bunch of things, was a public figure, a poet, sort of an arrogant poet. He thought his poetry was better than anybody else's. And he is involved in Jewish affairs. He's involved in Russia in petitioning the government to release political prisoners, including Jewish political prisoners in 1910, 11, 12, and his realization that the Tsarist regime is horribly anti-Semitic and the Jews are suffering led him to Zionism and to move to Eretz Yisrael. He befriended the leading figures in the Zionist movement, including Weizmann, who said nice things about him in 1919. But then he gravitated towards ultra-Orthodoxy, and he became a devotee of Rabbi Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld, who was the leader of the Eidei Charedis of Agudas Yisrael upon its founding in Eretz Yisrael. And the Eidei Charedis, they are petitioning all sorts of world powers to undo the Balfour Declaration and to exempt the Palestinian Haredim from the pernicious influence of the Zionist movement, and to give them exemptions, that we're not part of that group. We want to be recognized separately. So they met with King Hussein. Who's King Hussein?
Iraq.
Okay, so King Hussein is the king of all Arabs. He's the father of Faisal and Abdullah. He's the Sharif of Mecca, we spoke about a few weeks ago, who announced that he's the king of all the Arabs. And really, he was just the king of Arabia from 1916 to 1924, when he's deposed by the Saudis. But in 1923, he claims to be the king of all the Hijaz and all the Arabs. So they speak to him, the Aguda, about, you know, we're not part of the Zionist movement, treat us differently, we're not one of them. And he was going to go to London, and he was going to pressure the British government to backtrack its commitment to the Zionists on the grounds that the Jews themselves, the real Jews, the good Jews, the religious Jews, are against it. So, before he's able to go to London...
Who among these religious Jews was in the forefront? Sonnenfeld?
Sonnenfeld, yeah.
He said this?
Yeah, yeah. Sonnenfeld was very anti-Zionist. Very, very, very.
I understand, but he aligned himself this way?
With Dahan, yeah. So Dahan is going to go to London. Before he has a chance to go, he's leaving the synagogue at Shaare Tzedek Hospital. Now, you know where Shaare Tzedek Hospital is on Rehov Yafo?
Yeah.
The old Shaare Tzedek Hospital on Rehov Yafo. So there was a shul in the hospital, and Dahan had come out from the minyan, and someone asks him, "Sir, do you have the time?" Looks at his watch, boom, three shots fired. Who killed him? So at the time, nobody knew. There was arrest made, it was a trial, it was let go because there was no evidence. We didn't know. It was pretty clear it was a Jewish hitman. In 1985, 61 years later, an Israeli journalist named Nakdimon interviewed Avraham Tehomi. Avraham Tehomi had been a Haganah leader, broke away to the Irgun, and then came back to the Haganah, then left the country and was in the diamond business, and then moved to Hong Kong. He had a colorful life. He lived to be about 90. Died in, I think, 1990. In 1985, he was interviewed and admitted, "I shot Dahan. I was the killer," 61 years before. And why'd you do it? Why'd you do it? So who ordered the hit? He said, "Yitzchak Ben Tzvi ordered the hit." Now, Yitzchak Ben Tzvi was the second president of the State of Israel. So now he was long dead by that point. He died in 1963 after an 11-year term as president. Yes, Ben Tzvi is remembered fondly by Israeli society. Okay, but Ben Tzvi ordered the hit. Why? Because Dahan was undermining Zionism. That he was a traitor. Like, V'lamal shini mal tihi tikva. And what happens to them? They get taken out. So he had to die, he had to go. That's what Tehomi said. This was the first, but not the last, political assassination in Eretz Yisrael, and not the last one of a Jew against a Jew. There'd be a few others over the years. But it was a shock to the system that a Jew would kill a Jew over politics. And it was a dark stain on the Yishuv for a little while. Okay. In 1925, let's get back to more positive things. On April 1st, 1925, Hebrew University opened with a big ceremony. 12,000 people gathered on Mount Scopus for this funeral, including 77-year-old Lord Balfour. Old Lord Balfour was trotted out from London. They brought him over on the boat that he could be there for Hebrew University. Well, Lord Balfour, in hindsight, would have been better off not coming. Because what happened? There was a contract put out for his death. The Arabs are angry with him. They always hated him. Balfour, you know, the Jews, the Arabs hate his guts. And here he's coming to rub salt in the wound, the Hebrew University. So Balfour foolishly wanted to take a Middle Eastern vacation out of this whole thing. If I'm going to go to Israel, I'll spend a few days, I'll make a vacation out of it. You know, people say that. So he went to Damascus and was, and you know, never go to Damascus, rule of thumb. But he was told, oh, there are people who are out to get you. So he got off the train one stop before Damascus, and then they attacked the train, thinking he was on it. And they were pushing the car, like right out of the movies, you know, they're threatening to knock it over, but he was already long gone. He drove in the getaway car through the dead of the night to Beirut and got on a ship and hightailed it out of the Middle East. But he was almost killed for his efforts. He was lucky to get out alive. All right. During the 1920s, immigration to Eretz Yisrael was on the basis of a quota. That quota was determined based upon economic capacity, which fluctuates all the time. So the policy was every 6 months there'd be a release of a new schedule of immigration. And this schedule of immigration divided the quota into categories of person. Agricultural workers, industrial workers, lazy bums, and you name it. I mean, different categories. And that's, they fill the quota. Who determined who gets to go in that quota? Meaning, the British determine the overall number. But as for individual people who get a certificate, who figures that out? Well, they left it to the Zionist movement to figure this out, and the Zionist movement left it to the Zionist officials who were working in the various cities of the diaspora to identify who was a worthy candidate who lived in their region. So there was tremendous power, eventually of life and death, when things got bad in the 30s, in the hands of local Zionist functionaries. And they were supposed to weed out all the lazy bums and only get people who were good human material. What kind of human material are we looking for? So young, strapping, strong people who can work with their hands. Right? Is that how it really worked itself out? Not always. Very often the people were corrupt. And individuals who had no intention of working hard, or who had disability, who were older, who were weak, you name it, people who were not going to go off to the kibbutz and take a shovel into the soil were making it into Israel under false pretenses. Because a couple of shekels and pesos put to the pocket of the right person and you got your certificate. So the higher ranking officials are furious. You know, fire that doctor who issued that medical certificate. Fire that official who issued the certificate. But that's the way it was throughout the 1920s and 30s. What also was important was the partification of society. The Yishuv and the Zionist movement more broadly has many political persuasions, ranging from communist to Politzion socialist, Achdut HaAvodah socialist, Shomer HaTzair socialist, General Zionist, Mizrahi, Agudas Yisrael, you name it. There's a whole wide variety of people. Well, the officials who give out the certificates, they want to give it out to their people, ideological kinsmen. So there has to be a distribution of the certificates based upon party that is analogous to the representation of these parties in the Zionist organization. So if you get elected on a slate, okay, and let's say you're the general Zionist and you win 30% of the vote, you get 30% of the certificates. If you're the revisionist and you get 7% of the vote, you get 7% of the certificates, and so on and so forth. So the elections to Zionist congresses are not just fun and games for a parliament of a non-state. It has life and death, real world consideration for people who want to go to a safe haven of Eretz Israel. Okay. Well, capitalists are not included in the quota. They're allowed into the country beyond the quota. What's a capitalist?
Money.
So someone who has capital, that's it. A capitalist is someone who has capital, period, end of story. How much capital do you need? 500 British pounds. If you have 500 British pounds, you are a capitalist and you can get in no problem. Yeah. Well, we need wealthy people. Okay. So the 1920s was a decade for building contractors, the Kablanim, okay? All right? And Tel Aviv grew very rapidly. If in 1920 there were 2,000 people in Tel Aviv, in 1924 there were 20,000. A tenfold increase in 4 years. That only is possible if you build and build and build and build.
And Yafo was how many people?
Yafo, Jewishly, it stagnated.
Total?
I don't know. I have to look that up. My guess is it was no more than 50,000 around that time. Yeah. And so it goes from 20,000 in 1924 to 40,000 in 1925. It doubled in size in 1 year. Tremendous. Yeah.
Was that because of business?
The rapid increase is because of considerable increase in the housing stock and mass immigration. We're going to talk about what kind of immigration that was in a few moments.
Jews,
absolutely Jews, yes.
Location must have been a decisive factor where it was located.
Location is a decisive factor because...
climatic situation was moderate compared to the South.
Also, people wanted to live in an urban environment. I'm going to explain in a second why that was so. Well, this rapid growth might have led to a chaotic development of the city. But the Zionist leadership and Mayor Dizengoff, the mayor of the of Tel Aviv, he wanted it to be a planned city, so municipal planning. Let it be a garden city with public spaces and parks. And so it was, that there was a careful decision that Tel Aviv should not look like Jerusalem or like Jaffa. It should look modern and well-ordered, with streets coming at a perpendicular angle, okay? Tel Aviv...
The report has here that Haifa is becoming the new Tel Aviv.
Yeah? Okay.
In what way?
I was there. It was closed. All right. So Jerusalem, whereas Jerusalem was built on rock, Tel Aviv was built on sand. And that means, metaphorically, that there are no great foundations. There is no great rootedness in Tel Aviv. It's all very transient and temporary, potentially, but with the ability to overturn the traditions of the past, because locally there are no traditions of the past. All right. Well, in the early 20s, as Tel Aviv was growing, there were those who didn't like it, and they attacked the commercialism of Tel Aviv, and they made fun of the soda fountain kiosks. That was a classic shtuch of Tel Aviv, was that on every block there was another seltzer guy or soda guy with a kiosk on the sidewalk. Okay? Out of Yom HaZeh, they had the lottery guys at the kiosks. But in those days, they were selling soda. And this was a sign of decadence, that people were indulging in pleasures and that the people were not working hard in the soil. So the kibbutzniks and the labor leadership were dismissive of the urban living and said it wasn't real Zionism. It's like bogus Zionism. Dizengoff did his best to try to, and the whole civil camp, tried to impress upon people that no, don't make fun of urban Zionism. There is just as much of a place for urban Zionism as there is for agricultural Zionism. That we need a little bit of everything, and that population is what's going to give us statehood, and population is not achieved on the farm, where you only have a handful of people and a lot of goats and cows. Population is achieved in a dense, compact city. Okay. So, those who were dismissive of the city, they said, minimize the books and maximize the hiking, and love the land and return to the soil. In 1926, there was a problem. The Polish economy went into recession. And this had a horrible ripple effect in Eretz Yisrael. Because much of the building in the 1920s was based upon land speculation and unpaid and unfinished construction. A lot of it was, paid. You pay 5% down, but the rest of it is, you're going to pay at some point along the way when you have the money. But if the economy goes south, there is no money to be had, no money to pay. Everything comes to a crashing halt. 1926 to 1928 were very bad years for the yeshuv in terms of economic well-being and demography. There were almost as many people leaving the country in 27 as there were entering. And in 28, there was a negative number. So on the whole, 26 to 28, the population stagnated at a time when, generally speaking, the population going up, 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 up. For 3 years, it stagnated. 15,000 Jews left the country in that three-year span. And we're not talking about a population that's very large. I mean, we're talking about the whole Jewish yeshuv is maybe 150,000 people at that point, 180,000, for 15,000 to leave. It's a lot. Okay? Europe, America, Canada, anywhere, South Africa, all over the place.
So the symptom of Yordim is...
The symptom of Yordim has been around since the days of Aliyah. Aliyah, Yerida, it goes hand in hand. Okay, so now what is the historiography of this? What is the legend, the myth? The legend and the myth is that there's a real distinction between the third Aliyah and the fourth Aliyah. The third Aliyah is 1919 to 1923. In the aftermath of World War I, these are socialists who are ideologically motivated to till the soil, and they are very, very devout and fabrenta Zionists. And they want to build up Eretz Yisrael from the soil. And who's the fourth Aliyah? The middle-class Polish bourgeois soda-drinking Aliyah. 1924 to 1926, 27, or 23 to 27. And who are these people? Well, they went to Palestine because of not necessarily great ideological fervor, but because life in Poland isn't all that wonderful, and maybe you can have a better life in Palestine, and they want to recreate in Tel Aviv the life they had in Warsaw. That's a big no-no. If Zionism means anything, it means the new Jew. You transform yourself. You don't just transform Eretz Yisrael. Banu livnot u lihibanot. We're going to build up ourselves. That means if you were a middle class or lower middle class shopkeeper on the streets of Warsaw, you go to Israel and you take a rake and shovel. You don't open up a soda shop or a candy store or a pizza joint. And yet that's what the fourth Aliyah people did. So says the historiography and the legend. In reality, it wasn't such a stark divide between the third and fourth Aliyah. Remember, these are just constructs. These are abstractions. In the real world, what happened? The third Aliyah had its urban dwellers and it had its agriculturalists, and the fourth Aliyah as well had some urban dwellers and had some agriculturalists. But yes, there was probably skewed a little bit more towards urban dwellers in the fourth than it did in the third. And that's why Tel Aviv shot up in population and had all of a sudden a dramatic decline economically around when Babe Ruth was hitting 60 home runs. So 1927 was a bad year. Yeah.
I'm saying, if you were saying the people who determined who got in were the local functionaries, unless the local functionaries change, why would the nature of the immigrants change?
Okay, the answer is that the quota wasn't always filled to capacity, and it was a pretty large quota. Not that many Jews want to move to Israel. So if Jews want to move, you let them in. When is the quota a problem? Really in the 30s. In the 20s, it was not as much of an issue. And so if there aren't that many people moving to the country who want to till the soil, you'll take what you can get. If you get bourgeois Jews from Warsaw who want to live in Tel Aviv, or they want to live even in Jerusalem or Haifa, you grab them and you hope they stay. They don't leave. Okay. Well, then there's a big push, and then there's a limit. The 60,000 was the most they ever had in any 1 year, 1935. Okay, so the Zionist movement wanted a state at all costs, even if this meant doing things that were economically nonsensical. So there were times in the 1920s that investments were made in something that would be not very profitable. And sometimes the kibbutzim themselves were not profitable in the beginning, or for a long stretch. But it was believed that sometimes we have to throw our money at a losing cause, economically speaking, because from a national point of view, it has tremendous value. And so contiguous settlement, settlement on the land, land purchases, it might be that we're making a mistake in raw economic terms, but we need to do this for the long run, for the building up of a Jewish homeland. And that's where the capitalists would argue, no, 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 everything should be based upon logical, economic, rational factors. And this is a debate where there's no one who's right, there's no one who's wrong. It all depends upon where your priorities are. If you want to make money, then don't throw your money down a losing proposition, if that's your main goal, your only goal. But if your goal is to build up the yeshuv, then sometimes you take a loss. You have to take a loss. And this is something that was true in the 19-aughts, in the 19-teens, 1920s, into the 1930s. That sometimes you do something that's economically stupid, but you need it for national purposes. Okay, back to cultural issues. Hebrew University. So Martin Buber shows up in May of 1927. And by the way, if I'm mentioning a lot all these Hebrew University things and people showing up and give a lecture, it's because this was a big deal. But we're talking about Jews. Jews like to learn. Intellectuals, they think of themselves very smart. So when a big chacham, a big scholar comes, it's a major occasion. All right. Well, Buber shows up in May of 27, and he's going to give a lecture on philosophy. But he wants to speak in German. Auf Deutsch bitte. Why? Because he said his Hebrew isn't good enough. That he could speak Hebrew, but he's uncomfortable speaking in Hebrew at this point. It needs to improve. So for the time being, let me speak in German. Now, ultimately, he'd be hired in 1938 as a professor of philosophy at Hebrew University, and he would spend the next 25 years being an illustrious professor. So by 1938, his Hebrew was good enough. But in 1927, his Hebrew wasn't good enough. So the Battalion for the Defense of the Language... That's a mouthful. The Battalion for the Defense of the Language. You could just imagine these 20-year-old kids, some of them students, some of them not students, the type to throw things and break windows and throw garbage cans. So Eliezer ben Yehuda died in 1922, and Achad Ha'am died in 1927. The only one who's still alive is Bialik, who died in 34, who are like the Gedolim of Hebrew. And so the Battalion for the Defense of Hebrew Language causes a big ruckus. They do a sit-in by Judah Magnus's office and tell Magnus, this is a Hebrew university, not German university. Don't let that guy speak. So that wasn't in the university, it was before it existed. And he spoke in French, but German is terrible. You know, German is the enemy. So in the end, Buber was allowed to speak. And the defense squadron had to make do with just a simple protest. But the defense battalion was not done. They made a squadron called the Sign Patrol. The Sign Patrol. What was the Sign Patrol? They look on the streets. Signs. Barbershop. Why does it say barbershop? It should say mispara. Why does it say laundromat? It should say tichboset. Why does it say... synagogue, it should say Beit Knesset, you know, whatever it is, the sign has to be in Hebrew. Street signs also. So they protested the British government that if you're going to have Arabic and English in the street signs, you have to have Hebrew also. Sometimes with success, sometimes without success. Then they protest for the right to send a telegram in Hebrew. And this was a major protest. The British said, we'd love to accommodate, but every telegram that is sent involves 11 employees on this end of the telegram, on that end of the telegram. You know, it's a lot of employees, human beings, who don't understand Hebrew because they're British civilians. So how could you impose upon them Hebrew telegrams? Plus, there's no Morse code for Hebrew. So they invented a Morse code for Hebrew. And we insist, Hebrew telegrams. Finally, after like a year-long protest, they got the Hebrew telegram. Okay. Then, here comes the big battle. Someone... A rich gvir from the Chutz La'aretz gave 100,000 British pounds, or whatever it was, some large amount of money, obscene amount of money, to endow at the university a chair in Yiddish. Yiddish. So you could understand that the Hebrew crowd is going to go berserk. And they say, no, 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 that jargon has no place in Eretz Yisrael. It's a diaspora thing, not to be to sully the sanctity of Hebrew University. Well, Magnus was in a jam. He didn't know what to do. Bialik actually favored having the chair in Yiddish because he felt that Yiddish is not a competitor to Hebrew. What's a competitor to Hebrew in Eretz Yisrael? English and Arabic. Those are the languages that the government is using and that people actually speak on the ground. Yiddish is dying. And what if we have a chair in Yiddish, so we'll preserve the memory of Yiddish of 1,000 years of Ashkenazic culture. But it's not really a threat to the Hebrew. But he was afraid to say it because the battalion for the defense of the language was causing so much of a ruckus. In the end, Magnus did the politik thing and politely thanked the generous donor and said, we'll have to defer this to a later time. Today, there's a chair in Yiddish at Hebrew University, but in 1927, it was too soon. Okay. I don't know. If I'm going to look that up. I'm not sure. I think post 48. Pretty sure. No, that's not obvious, but I'm pretty sure it's post 48. That could be. I really don't know. I don't know.
This linguistic controversy is then new. France and Quebec, they insisted English letters would be smaller than the French letters. And in Greece, they actually go out of the way to try to translate common English phrases that have infiltrated into Greek.
It's a real Greek, right. So in Israel today, unfortunately, there's the trend is to adopt as Hebrew what are really English words, and to ignore the Hebrew words that were created by the Academia HaLashon HaEvrit and by Elias Ben Yehuda years ago because nobody uses them. So anyway, now the last thing for tonight is the sale of land. In the 1920s, JNF is buying land, large chunks of land. And where do they want to buy it? Well, they want arable land, fertile land, not in the middle of nowhere in the Negev, and they want it to be contiguous with existing Jewish settlement, because otherwise you're going to have a hodgepodge here or there, and it'll be defenseless. So who's selling the land? Well, there were prominent Arabs involved in the Palestinian Arab National Movement who were secretly guilty of selling land to Jews, and could be blackmailed after the fact, because they didn't want anybody to know. So this was a very good thing for the Zionist movement. Number one, they got the land, and number two, they have compromising information on sensitive people. Okay, now, the Zionist movement bought off prominent Arabs throughout the 1920s to have them tamp down the rhetoric of their anti-Zionism. But this didn't really work in the long run. Ben-Gurion believed that almost every Arab was able to be bought off. But because they could be bought off, then the negotiating with them is useless because someone else will buy them off. That you can't maintain your control over them. That the real negotiations with the Arabs could only be with the most ideologically driven, and they were the least inclined to negotiate. Okay. So this issue of purchasing land is something that the Arab National Movement was embarrassed about because they were the sellers, but they want to get the British to forbid it. Because if the British forbid it, then it doesn't happen. Then the deed can't be transferred, the title can't be transferred from one to the other. This is something that the Jewish agency is going to have to protest against whenever the British are intimating that they're going to forbid land purchases. In the 1930s, and after the White Paper 39 into the 40s, this is a major problem. But in the 1920s, it's only a potential problem. For the most part, land is available. Yeah?
Are the sellers lawful, or are they absentee landlords?
Okay, so there is, in the historiography, the tendency is to say, well, the landowners were these effendis who lived in Beirut and Damascus, or Aleppo, or Constantinople, and that the locals who lived to till the soil were tenant farmers who sadly got the boot whenever the sale was made from the absentee landlord. That was true some of the time, maybe even a lot of the time, but not all the time. Sometimes there were people who lived on the soil, and they sold, and they left. And where did they go? To the cities in Palestine. Because
Arab, the dense population of Arabs in the cities in Palestine is a phenomenon of the 20th century. Where they're coming from, in part from other countries, but also from farmers who lived in country. Okay, actually, one more thing for tonight, and that is Hebrew labor, Avodah Ivrit. What's the opposite of Avodah Ivrit? Avodah Zara. Avodah Zara, foreign labor. Okay, idolatry, foreign labor. So if the Arabs work, it's Avodah Zara. If the Jews work, it's Avodah Ivrit. The problem as the 1920s progresses is that Avodah Ivrit costs money. It's too expensive. Avodah Zara is cheap. Okay, very cheap. So how do you solve this problem? So one solution is to for the employers to take one for the team and just pay the Jews a living wage. And why do the Jews need more money than the Arabs? Why? Because the Jews need a shower and a newspaper. That's what was said. The Jews need a shower and a newspaper. They're literate and they have hygiene. And that costs money. Okay? Standard of living. So what's the solution to the Jewish labor being too expensive? So one is they found a tribe of Bedouin Jews who live near Baghdad and they want to import them because they'll work for cheap. Or there's a tribe of Bedouin Gentiles who live in the Galilee who want to convert to Judaism. So send the chief rabbinate to give them a bris en masse. Okay, or Yemenite Jews, because they have a low standard of living and they'll work for cheap. All these are theories that are being thrown around throughout the 1920s about how we can't deal with the fact that Jews are too expensive to employ. Let's find some Jewish solution to the issue of the need of cheap labor. Now, by the way, there's a concept in the Gemara, Kol HaKone Eved Ivri, Kekone Adon Latzmo. What does that mean? He who buys a Hebrew slave acquires a master for himself. Now, why is that? Because in the Torah, what's the rule? The Torah, the Eved Ivri has protections. You have to give him money when he leaves. You have to give him a blanket and a pillow, and give three meals and a, you know.
The Eved Ivri is the best.
Okay, so the Eved Ivri has it pretty good according to the Bible. So the Talmud says if you acquire an Eved Ivri, it's like you acquire a master for yourself. So Burl Katznelson, David Ben-Gurion's best friend and buddy and the leader of the labor Zionist movement, said, he quoted the Talmud, if you get Hebrew labor, you're like an Adon for yourself because they have demands and demands and demands. Who makes no demands? The poor schlep Arab. He makes no demands. It's easier to hire him. Yeah.
That's why I've been hearing this for the longest time, the dirty little secret of the Jewish state is the fact that there is this kind of discrimination against those Jews from Arab countries.
So that was relied upon for economic upbuilding so long as you could get away with it. But once you can no longer get away with it, then foreign laborers became the minhag, whether from Africa, the Philippines, wherever. Now, in post-67, of course, you have Palestinians from the territories. But post-1987, Intifada, those are not very desirable. So then you need to have foreigners. You know. Okay, so we'll stop here.